not the military industrial media. This is Active Ingredients, online at activeingredients.org. Vijay Prashad spoke August 2007 at Food for Thought Books in Amherst, Mass. This is the second talk by Vijay I have posted, and we are fortunate to have him as a neighbor. Please pardon the road mic sound. Anyway, Vijay Prashad gave the closing keynote address of UMass Geo. They hosted the 16th Coalition of Graduate Employees, CGEU, conference. Graduate Union Conference Coalition formed in 1992, and I quote, to support the organization of new graduate employee unions, to strengthen the established unions, and to provide a forum for graduate employee unionists to meet, share information, and work together towards common goals. The theme for the 16th CGEU conference is, I quote, taking on corporate university. About our theme, in the face of increasing corporatization of both public and private universities, we would like to take the opportunity of this year's conference to address the trend from our unique positions as organized student employees. This corporatization is taking on many forms, including the dismantling of academic programs, attack on student and faculty governance structures, and attempts to roll back our hard-won benefits, and in some cases, our entire unions. At the 16th CGEU conference, we would like to focus on the possibilities for strengthening our own organizations while linking up with a rising wave of student and labor activism in and around our universities. Nothing to say but go, go, go. Now, Vijay Prashad at Food for Thought Books.
Good evening, everybody. This is the last event of our conference. We have Professor Vijay Prashad, an old professor of mine from Trinity College, speaking. He's written books like The Karma of Brown Folk, Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting. His newest book is called The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. I have no idea what he'll be speaking about, but definitely something worthwhile and interesting.
Hi, good evening. I hope you've had a good conference. Yes, what will I be speaking about? I'm going to talk about financialization and try to reframe the problem of what's happening to higher education away from privatization and towards financialization. So that's the broad theme. But first, I'd like to talk a little about France. Today's an important day. It's, the day when the American elites can once more rejoice, because for about 6 years, it's been difficult for the American elites to be openly francophilic. But today, everything has changed, because in Kennebunkport, Maine, Nicolas Sarkozy and George Bush had a little love fest. So finally, the elites can come back to French wine and everything that's proper about civilization. So all those transatlantic rifts that had been proposed about 6 years ago, the inter-imperialist rivalries that were being celebrated, at least some of it seems to have healed, at any rate. So to France, then, this lecture is dedicated. I also wanted to start somewhere else, which is with a speech given, I think, last year by John Carroll, who used to be a fairly distinguished editor of the Los Angeles Times before that newspaper ran itself deep into the gutter. John Carroll gave a speech about, what it's become now, I suppose, rather cliched to talk about the demise of the American newspaper. And a lot of people have been weighing in on this. Some believing that it's technology that's undoing the newspaper. In other words, either that people are getting their news on the internet, blogs, etc., and then the newspapers come back with, I think, worthwhile studies that show that, well, most people who write in blogs actually, are simply parasitic on newspapers, that they don't do original reporting. So maybe it's not the blogs that will kill the newspapers. Well, then the next way in which technology is supposed to have destroyed the newspaper is by creating a youth, a global youth, who have short attention spans, who like their news in bite-size, segments. Maybe it used to be a four-minute segment on television, and now it's about maybe 15 seconds. So there's a declining ability to concentrate. That's the second sort of objection to the newspaper, which requires, I'm told, considerable acumen and time. And you have to sit and read it, and you have to digest it. Now, reading American newspapers, I've actually never felt that you need to take a lot of time or have much intelligence. But at any rate, that's the second sort of objection, that technology, by reducing the attention span of the audience, is killing the newspaper. So these are the two broad ways in which people have understood the demise of the newspaper. Well, the third way is that, somehow Rupert Murdoch is to blame. Because you get this Australian, again, not French, he has no culture, he comes from the outback, he's a ruthless guy, he's not very attractive, and he shows up in, London. He shows up first, of course, in Australian cities. Then he shows up in London. He buys, the great old newspapers, the Times, things like that. And then he runs color photographs initially, of all horrible things. You must remember that the newspapers like the Times used to have as the front cover not news but ads. In the old days, 100 and some years ago, the front cover of a main newspaper was just classified advertisements. And then you'd go inside for the news. Well, that's been long forgotten in the imagination of the elites, who were horrified to find color photographs on the cover of the newspaper. And then, of course, later celebrity news. Well, now, if you come back to the short attention span argument, it appears that young people like celebrity news. So maybe Murdoch was onto something. He splashed celebrity news on the newspapers, and therefore, in fact, perhaps driving television to produce, this kind of celebrity news thing. After all, Bill O'Reilly, who becomes one of Murdoch's American attack dogs, had his start in a program which essentially did celebrity news. So the third objection was that this Murdoch character and people like him are ruining newspapers because they have no class, essentially. If they had some kind of upbringing, if they went to Harvard, if they had the correct friends and connections, they'd understand that the Wall Street Journal is one of the finest newspapers in the land. And it's Murdoch who's going to ruin it. The Bancroft family have been protecting this jewel of American journalism from, the outliers, such as, for instance, the Chicago Tribune, the Hartford Current, the oldest continuous newspaper in the United States, etc. Okay, so the third objection is that it's a question of people of bad upbringing who are ruining the newspapers. Now, John Carroll comes up with something quite interesting. He says, look, it's not a question of technology by itself, although it's contributory. And it's not just that people like Murdoch are the wrong kind of people, but something has changed in the American newspaper. And of course, he is better positioned to tell us because he knows something about this. As I said, he was the editor of the Los Angeles Times in a very turbulent period. And what Carroll says is interesting. He says that there's a cultural shift in the newsroom. And the cultural shift has come from the following problem, which is that the publisher no longer understands what the ordinary newspaper reporter, editor, photo editor, photographer do. The publisher has no idea what happens to make a newspaper function. There's a cultural disconnect between those who run the newspaper and those who work in the newspaper. Those who run the newspaper, in other words, now associated often with money, not just with, say, family money who own a paper, but people whose job it is to make money, finance, people from the world of finance capital. They've come into the business of owning newspapers, and they're not interested in news, they're interested in profit. So they are willing to, for instance, cut back on foreign correspondence. That's one of the early casualties. Or cut back on original reporting. They'll pool reporting. They'll utilize, or they'll buy 8-9 newspapers and group together, you know, the Northeast under one, you know, or two reporters, and they report for all the papers. So the people who now run the newspaper rather than who work in the newspaper to make news come on the print are interested not so much in news any longer. They are interested in profit. Now, at one level, this is not a surprise. I mean, people who own any kind of, you know, major media house, etc., they've always been interested in money. But what Carol says is interesting, and it's indicative of a kind of liberal critique of what's occurring. What Carol says is now these people who own the newspaper are only interested in money. They are no longer even somewhat interested in the news. They're primary and solitary interest is in money. In other words, the newspaper has become for them just another commodity. This is very important when we think about education. Because until recently, the intellectual institutions of advanced capitalist countries have kept themselves insulated from policies of neoliberalism. Because there's been this idea that these are intellectual goods that have some merit in and of themselves. You cannot treat education like you can treat a bag of turnips. You cannot treat newspapers like you can treat, for instance, barrels of oil. That those are commodities of a low kind, but somehow insulated by this kind of high cultural understanding of intellectual life. Newspapers, education have been insulated from a dynamic that has been occurring for at least 3 decades. And now there's an assault on these intellectual institutions. The media, which has experienced the assault in a dramatic way, and higher education. Two places where we reproduce culture, or at least ideology, where we reproduce the world of ideas, are facing the attack in a similar fashion. Now, just think about what John Carroll's liberal, heartfelt critique of the newspaper says about where I've worked, the different institutions I've taught at. It's quite true that I started teaching 13 years ago, and even 13 years ago, the kinds of people who were running the college, presidents, provosts, etc., had often come up the ranks. Increasingly, they come from the world of money or politics. Increasingly, they are money professionals. Increasingly, they're not from the faculty, or they're not from people who have lived through their life in some kind of higher education institution. They are people who are delegated by trustees or by legislatures to come and put things in financial order. Their job is financial. You know, there used to be an old saw that the presidents of colleges were just to raise money. But this was not always true. Presidents also roamed the lawns, they chatted with people, they created a kind of, you know, esprit de corps, etc. Now their solitary job is to raise money and to be ruthless with the books. So there's a marked change if you inhabit that liberal critique, as Carol suggests, for the newsroom. There's also a marked change in the world of education, that those who are running things are in a different cultural orbit now than those who work in the trenches. That is to say, teachers, the staff, TAs, etc., have a very different understanding of what they're doing from those who are the runners, those who are the operators of this institution, that is to say, of higher education. There's something analogous about what's happening in the academy as what has occurred quite ruthlessly in media. But this is, again, a limited critique. Because, as I said, John Carroll's view is of a practitioner, a liberal practitioner, who saw something quite nasty happen to the newsroom and wanted to speak from the heart. But there was no analysis there. So how do we take that sort of, you know, heartfelt critique? And I've already analogized it and said that, you know, there's something occurring within public higher education and private higher education in the United States and in many other advanced industrial countries. Something analogous is occurring, there's a real disjuncture between the views of those who run institutions and the views of those who work in them. That analogy I'll take for granted. Now let's try to analyze the nature of that analogy. How do we understand what's occurring? For that, we need some background. About 25, 30 years ago, when there was a decline in global profitability for advanced industrial countries, finance was freed of restriction. And you saw at that time finance escape from the United States, escape from Western Europe, and go to, you know, countries in what is today known as the Global South. It was the birth of the debt crisis. But finance essentially was freed from restriction. That's the first thing we need to understand. That's the backdrop of what neoliberalism was going to do. You know, there's a wonderful essay by Walden Bellow, which appeared in an issue of Third World Quarterly toward the end of last year about globalization, where Bellow argued that globalization isn't a descriptive term. It's not something that is supposed to describe what occurs in the 1990s. Globalization is a set of policies conjured up by managers in the advanced industrial countries to preserve the power, the political power of the advanced industrial countries. In other words, there was an economic problem that they were facing, problem of overproduction, problem of the fact that finance had fled, gone overseas, that productivity had declined, the price of labor had become high, etc. There was a political and economic problem. And this was to be a package of institutional pressures coming from the advanced industrial states to preserve their primacy. That's what Bellow argues is globalization. It's not a descriptive reality. It's a prescription to preserve the power of advanced industrial states. Now, if you take that to be so, under globalization, one set of policies is what we know as neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is a simple idea. It's the idea that the state as an entity must not interfere in the market, or it must interfere as little as possible. In other words, that you need to create policies which don't have the state as a primary actor in creating demand, for instance, you know, in the market, or in trying to dispense justice. That the state is not a dispenser of justice. It goes back to a book that Hayek wrote in 1944 called The Road to Serfdom, where essentially Hayek argued that the more you try to dispense justice, the more you're going to create some kind of totalitarian nightmare. That this good intention will have the worst outcome. So it's better, therefore, not to try to do anything. Let these four abstract forces produce some kind of optimum. Abstract forces are better able to do it than humans trying to come in and put reins to history. It's a very disturbing, melancholy kind of approach to human reality. But it's quite it became very powerful from the 1980s onwards. And the proof of this, of course, is that Hayek became so well regarded finally after being for years in the cold. Margaret Thatcher considered him her great intellectual, advisor. I think he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Ronald Reagan. He was celebrated before he died. Some people take so long to die that eventually they become well regarded. This is my personal hope, that if I live for another 50 years, maybe someday we'll be making some kind of revolution somewhere, that people won't just say another crazy lefty is been on the planet and left it. So Hayek lived beyond Keynesianism and saw his time at the end of his life. It was gratifying for him personally, but not for the rest of humanity. But anyway, the simple thing with neoliberalism is the state must not act. The state must be held back. Well, of course, this meant since the workers' struggles of the 19th century, it wasn't just Keynes, but it was the workers' struggle globally from the 19th century onward, produced an idea of the state as a dispenser of social wages, of the public good. In other words, you collect wages from people, deferred wages into a social wage, and you produce public goods, including public education. But of course, public transportation, you know, public space, public water supplies. I was so happy to read finally that Pepsi Cola has accepted and admitted that their so-called bottled water, well, it is bottled water. It's not so-called bottled water, but it comes from Ayers, Massachusetts, from the public water supply. That's Aquafina, you know. So those of you who have been ridiculous enough to spend, you know, probably, I don't know, 0.1% of your annual budget on bottled water, you can just go to Ayers now. And now Dasani has also admitted that it's tap water. I was telling Erica, you know, Berkshire bottle there, it probably is Northampton water, or worse yet, Pittsfield, which is all the effluents from GE. At any rate, the idea of producing the public good was cemented in the, you know, the general imaginary of the population through these struggles. And that was the understanding of the state by the 1920s, 30s, 40s, that the state had to be a participant in galvanizing resources from the population through deferred wages and producing public institutions, including public space. And so you could have the state, you know, essentially dispensing civilization. Well, as I said, by the 70s and 80s, when there was this crack and a political crack, you see, what the you know, what the mainstream thinkers like to promote for us is this view that these things are just happening. They are abstract. Globalization just occurs. Not that these are political instruments that are honed and utilized to shape reality. That it's not that, you know, suddenly, well, the state, you know, one day becomes a completely unproductive entity and should be dispensed with. No, there was a crisis, and some powers act in a particular way, and they acted to desiccate the state. Now, this is very impressive, what they do. In the matter of about two decades, what they do is they start to cannibalize the institutions of the public. So that you start vanishing, you know, public space. You'll evict people who are on public space and give the land for private real estate development. You will end pension schemes that are universal and that are perhaps publicly held entirely, and you'll privatize them. You will open out and let, you know, Social Security wither. You will allow private monies to enter into healthcare. Now, keep in mind that where finance was fleeing outside advanced industrial countries, this cannibalization of the state was a sure way to bring that finance back into those domains that were not to be commodified. So you commodify those domains, which had been held outside the commodity form to some extent. You know, so healthcare, you bring money that would have gone to, say, dam projects elsewhere and screwed people elsewhere, and made a lot of money for money. Instead of that, you bring that money in and say, no, you can go into public transportation. We're going to privatize trains. So bring that money, secure it, and set it free within your own society. So there was money returning through neoliberal policies back into the advanced industrial states. And that's the boom in the 1990s, when that money comes back in. And it starts colonizing spaces that had been held outside the commodity form. And it's in that period that higher education faces this very peculiar dance in the 1990s. And, you know, I recommend occasionally when I'm bored, I download papers from, you know, the ACE or RAND or some of these higher education think tanks. And they have fascinating reports right from about 1993, 94, where they're deciding that there's a crisis in higher education, how to solve it. You know, should we have should we have for-profit universities? Or how do we deal with the fact that there are these subjects taught which have no value? You know, especially humanities and cultural studies and, you know, lesbianism and sexuality. And there's no value in any of this. Let's somehow harness the energy back to science. And a certain kind of science where there's an immediate return. Or let's stop teaching, you know, multiculturalism. I mean, what is that after all? You know, are we going to celebrate all cultures universally? It's a ridiculous notion. Let's walk away from that and teach the great books. So there are these reports that talk about things that, you know, you wonder, why is somebody in RAND interested in multiculturalism? Well, what they're really interested in is how to crack open this major public good which has been held off from the commodity form, how to allow private capital in there. There's a lot of money that can be made in selling people dreams, especially where we have this interesting crack in our society with a high aspiration among the population, lower middle class onwards, a high aspiration. I can do anything if I get education, etc. Huge number of people going to college. You know, what is it? Some 75% of the population wants to go to college. Very near number eventually does go to some kind of college. High aspirational, quotient. And of course, you know, success rates are not that high. I mean, people's dreams are not being met, but you can take advantage of that aspiration. You can produce packaged goods that cater to that aspiration. You know, you can produce, for instance, tutoring classes. You can produce, for instance, private colleges that will help you get into the best medical school, things like that. Those are packages that can be commodified and sold to a public which has very high aspirations, even though the reality of jobless growth means they probably will not be hired into anything that they want to be hired into. I mean, think about this. The most liberal guy running for governor of Massachusetts a few years ago was Robert Reich. And when he came to Western Mass, all he talked about was the biotech sector. He said, we want to make Western Mass, which is, you know, suffers from joblessness, we want to make Western Mass the center of biotechnology. Now, how many people are you going to hire for biotechnology? You'll hire janitors to clean those offices. You'll hire perhaps some electricians to maintain the lighting and such. But all the products are going to be produced in Malaysia. They'll be produced in China. They'll be produced elsewhere. There'll be a small percentage of people here who'll be actually working in those labs and creating goods which will be patented and upon which they'll earn rent. Small percentage. So the aspirations of the population are much, much higher than what the society is capable of meeting. But it's that aspiration that finance takes advantage of. You can create commodified packages, educational packages, to sell to young people who want to do something with their lives, because culturally we have said anybody can do anything, and it's that finance was interested in. But the barrier to all that is all this other stuff. You know, that education is to build citizenship, that education is to build people, especially undergraduate education, to prepare you for the world at large. Therefore, you need to have, you know, wide range of things that you should study. Therefore, you know, you need to cater as well to what students want. You know, in other words, students as customer. I mean, students as customer is both a good and a bad thing as far as finance is concerned. Because if students are asking for, you know, things that are not really that, you know, easily commodified and produced, then it's not a valuable thing. I mean, I'm a great critic of multiculturalism on the grounds that it's easily commodified. I mean, what's not easily commodified is anti-racism. But, of course, we don't talk about that. We talk about multiculturalism, about, you know, the need to affirm identities. You can commodify the sale of identities. I mean, you have 100 people who are on the lecture circuit every year trying to affirm your identity. You know, they go to the ethnic enclaves, or they go to a human rights thing, you know, and then affirm somebody's views. That's what they pay. You know, that's what they get paid to do. But you can't commodify, anti-systemic thinking, I don't think. But we don't go that way. I'll come back to that in a little bit when I talk a few remarks on affirmative action. So this was finance's interest, to enter into higher education, but you had to smash all this other stuff. And the outcomes of finance's move into from the 1990s onwards is quite severe. Because even if, for now, for-profit education is a tiny percentage of the entire landscape, the cultural result of that attack has been enormous. And that's why I'm going to suggest in a few minutes that really what unionization on campuses is about is as much a cultural attack against this as it is, say, a fight for wages, as it is a fight for better conditions or better kind of curriculum. We need a major cultural shift. We need to fight back against an enormous cultural shift that is now destabilized higher education in quite a severe way, I would suggest. So from the 90s, what has been held? What has been held is that an educational institution has to be, for instance, competitive. Now, what does this mean for higher public education? Well, it means, for instance, that you need to have be selective in who you take in, which already is a problem. You know, it means that as states are decreasing their outlay to public education, because that's a consequence that they are facing because of neoliberal cuts. You know, you must cut taxes. You must stop financing civilization. You must increase the financing of repression. In neoliberalism, some people argue always that, well, the state is disappearing. They don't understand what's happening. What's happening is the state has simply shifted its focus. The state no longer dispenses justice, but it dispenses what it calls justice, which is more police, more prisons, more armies. It's shifted its focus. It's not a shrinking state. It's simply shifted what it does. So, you know, in that wise, there's less money coming to education. So what does a campus, say, like UMass do? What they do is, interesting, they need to increase their resource base. There are only three ways for colleges generally to increase resource base. One is tuition, the other is through the endowment, and the third is annual giving. Public schools in general, endowments and annual giving are not a very fruitful way of raising money. I mean, down the road, Smith has and Amherst have endowments of about $1 billion. They are able, per student, to amass a huge amount of money, not only through giving, but also drawing out of the endowment. But a school like the University of Massachusetts cannot rely on endowment, cannot rely on annual giving to make up for the cutback in state support. So it's all about tuition. Well, then they come up with the gimmicks. Instead of tuition, you have fees, the increases through fees. And these means, because you need to increase your resource base. Now, you're increasing your resource base, but you're not paying your faculty more because you're starting to fragment how teaching occurs. You have, as you know, of course, teaching assistants, things like that. And then faculty will become have increased workload. So now the rate is 21, I think it's almost 22 students per faculty at public institutions. At private institutions in the same period, there's been a decline from 15 to 12 students per faculty member. There's been a decline in the same period. But the divide between public and private is erroneous in this era, because what both are facing is the dominance of finance over educational imperatives. And that's the commonality. That's why I'm not comfortable with this being talked about as privatization. It's not really privatization. It's the financialization of the educational sector, where education is becoming an adjunct to the question of making money. That's the broad assault on education. Because private institutions are facing similar pressures. Of course, they are insulated because they have those endowments. They have that ability to draw annual giving, you know, money from alumni. But they're facing the same pressures. So if we want to be analytic about it, we should see the pressures and the kind of processes that are at work rather than how these colleges are able to make themselves into an island. You know, they're both facing the pressures. They can insulate themselves a little more. But it has similar kinds of effects on students. Let's take the question of the students and come to that problem of revenge and race. So you have a declining number of, declining pool of money for all institutions, private and public. The pools have declined of, say, money they're able to give students, how many students can come on simply grants and not loans. The pool has declined in all these institutions, except a few. Harvard, I mean, they are real islands. You know, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, there are some that just live in a different planet. But by and large, the pool has declined. So when the pool declines, since there's no political attack at this cultural shift, the discourse on the shrunken pool is an attack on affirmative action. So because we haven't assembled a clever political fight on this cultural shift, we are forced to defend things like affirmative action. We haven't demonstrated how this shrunken pool has produced this revanchist attack on the small and tiny and puny kind of way to, you know, democratize institutions, affirmative action. It's the most innocuous form of, you know, admissions planning. I mean, it's a tiny thing. It's not some major, you know, transformation. It's tiny and its effects have been tiny. But we are forced to defend affirmative action because we're not having the broader cultural fight, political fight over this shift. What do I mean by that? I mean, affirmative action, as I said, it's a small issue. But it's an issue that's framed around a kind of neoclassical financialized logic. I, about 15 years ago or 12 years ago, debated Dinesh D'Souza on the theme of affirmative action. And it was a South Asian gathering, so they had two South Asians. They were all South Asians in the hall. And we were debating about issues where people were initially in agreement with him that Asians were being affected by affirmative action policies. And so that was the kind of sense of the hall. Then he offered his analogy. And just see this analogy, because this analogy actually is the logic of the attack on affirmative action. The analogy was that, look, I have a sandwich, and I'm eating my sandwich. And as I'm eating my sandwich, you come and you take my sandwich from me, and you eat my sandwich. Now, is that fair? And you see, everybody, of course, says, of course it's not fair. You know, you're eating a sandwich. But you see how the model is. The model is the neoclassical model of scarcity and choice. There's a scarce good, which is a sandwich. And you have to make a choice of who gets to have the sandwich. You can't share the sandwich. But either you get it or I get it. Now, if I have it, from that neoclassical, you know, resource scarcity question, you have to take my sandwich for you to have it. There's no other way. So my question to him was, isn't the world organized in the way that one person has 100 sandwiches and 100 people have no sandwiches? I mean, isn't that more realistic than two people fighting over one sandwich? But he didn't see either the humor of it or the fact that it was trying to expand his framework, because his framework is generally neoclassical. Now, how do we deal with a broader framework? I mean, every time we defend affirmative action, why don't we talk about the fact that there should be more colleges built? That we live in a society with the capacity to build colleges where everybody who applies to college should get a seat. Why can't we talk about that? Why do we have to desiccate our cultural imagination and fight on the terms of scarcity and choice? I mean, we need to demand culturally more, not less. We need to be culturally much more aggressive, especially culturally. And by that I mean that this is not just a fight about the situation as it is. The only way to defeat financialization is to defeat its terms. If you accede to its terms and you debate on its terms, the game is over. Because neoclassical thinking, which broadly is the thinking of financialization, will always defeat you. You see, I'm not talking about how economists will then wield charts and figures and numbers, and most people are, you know, just sort of zapped by the figures. And, you know, economics, it's not just a dismal science, but there are some games that happen, which is that you can say something in language, but instead of, so when you read the economics paper, they'll say that there's a sandwich, and then they'll say, sandwich is X. And then if you reduce X to, so then a graph will be made of something that you can actually just talk through in prose. So, which is why sometimes I feel like, you know, the book Freakonomics was such a hit, because they actually tried to put into prose what are generally quite interesting ideas, but which economists hide behind symbols. But we are paralyzed by not only their symbols, but their framework. You see, we're willing to allow them to set so many parameters, and then we want to fight against their parameters. But we need to break their parameters. We need to constantly deny that their parameters are the real world. See, that's the trick that they play, is that they'll suggest to you that their framework is reality. It's the mirror of nature. They have shown a mirror to nature, and it's their framework. See, we have to demonstrate to them that their mirror is warped, that they're not actually able to see what can be thought for the bulk of humanity. the revenge and race question is very important. You know, this you cannot deal with financialization unless we deal with how race is fractured through it. Because the impact, financialized impact, is often, especially in undergraduate level, brought through on the race angle. That is, it's race that's used to smash the academy. You know, this idea that you're not promoting merit, you're promoting, you know, identity. You see what the 13 southern schools have done, 13 southern states, public institutions, they have now decided that, look, the way we're going to give out our grants is by merit. And it's the top 30% of high school students that will get the merit. There's no other criteria. You have to be... Now, in some states, there's mixed results. Like in Texas, there's been some mixed results. But in most states, the vast number of people getting these grants are white and middle class. Because that's what you'll find. I mean, if you say that history is off the books and we'll just take reality as it stands, then those who have enjoyed some privileges of history, they're obviously going to win. I mean, that's a no-brainer to me. You know, this is not to disparage anybody. This is just the way reality works. If you've stolen for 100 years of history, obviously you are going to be in a better position today than somebody who was stolen from. I mean, that's just reality. But it's very clever that race becomes the battering ram for financialization. So what happens is you start desiccating your pot of money that you're giving out in general, and you defend it on the grounds that we're giving merit scholarships now. See, race is that's why I keep insisting that our fight is cultural. It's not just a fight about economics. It's a cultural fight. Because they are fighting it also culturally, and they've won the cultural war to a large extent. Because they've put at the centerpiece is merit. And that has to be destabilized. What does merit mean? You know, what does merit allow? Merit allows us to shrink the number of seats on a campus and then let only the so-called high achievers take them. It's already preparing people for the jobless economy. That only 10% of those in a high school class or 30% should come to college. Of them, 8-9% will be real successes. And they will produce some product which they can patent, and they can live off the rent from that patent for the rest of their life. The good that's patented will be made in China and sold to the American public, who will get free credit from the Chinese. That's the jobless economy we have today, and that's what is being reproduced by this form of managing higher education. This form of higher education, in other words, is higher education of the jobless economy. Okay. I mean, there's also something immoral, by the way, about how it impacts public institutions in particular. And immorality is that if you can't raise endowment or you can't raise annual giving, and if you're raising tuition for undergraduates, that tuition is also paying doctorate students, you know, to do their degrees. Now, you think about it, you know, corporations really get such subsidies. And here, I said, it's immoral because here, you know, low-income, working class, lower middle class undergraduates are subsidizing corporations because they are subsidizing graduate students to go and do their degrees, and then corporations will hire them. I mean, one reason I oppose giving grades to my students is that grades has become meaningless in my class now. I don't care who's better than who. It's not relevant to me. I'd fail all of them because they're all illiterate to begin with anyway. But it's not relevant to me. Grades are relevant generally to their employer when they leave. And even that's not that relevant. The interview is relevant. You know, things like... But grades, they worry about, students worry about because of jobs. What do I care about jobs, you know? So you see how the corporations have a subsidy. And the subsidy is coming from student tuition. Undergraduate tuition, that's the immorality of this way neoliberalism functions in higher education. Not only have you culturally produced a situation which is racist, as I suggested, you know, through the idea of merit and such, but you've also produced an immoral situation where working class, lower middle class young people are subsidizing the corporations which will never hire them in a meaningful capacity. because they are paying for doctoral students who will then go use that skill to work for big corporations. I mean, this is an immoral system. But again, we can't think of it as immoral. We can't think of it as culturally devoid of any substance because our framework has to be neoliberal. So the challenge is a cultural challenge because that's what they did in the 1970s and 80s. They shifted the terms of cultural discourse. They allowed Hayek, for instance, to come back to life and to be the hero. They allowed the idea, you know, that it was acceptable to create institutions which didn't attempt to secure justice for the population. That was acceptable now. We have to culturally shift the terms once again. That's what unionization is about. Just in closing, I'm going to say that, you know, one of the interesting things about higher education or any education, you know, even in high schools and such nowadays, and has been for a while, is the problem of what teachers think we do. I mean, we have a highly inflated idea of ourselves in the classroom, as if the classroom is the reproducer of culture. Actually, in my opinion, the classroom is just 10% of what is occurring. I mean, culture is reproduced in the architecture of a college campus. You know, it's reproduced in the fact that you can go out on the weekend, vomit, and somebody else will clean up after you. It's reproduced by the fact that you can flip off somebody working in a cafeteria and you get away with it. It's reproduced by the fact that the administration wants to protect the undergraduate students from the police, from impunity. You know, in other words, I'm getting high in my room. I get a call from campus, say, put your cocaine away because there's a raid now. We don't want any embarrassing situations. You know, there's been sexual violence on campus. We won't release the statistics because it's too embarrassing for us. You know, that's really how culture is being reproduced. Young people believe now that they can do any damn thing they want and they'll be protected. And what we teach in the classroom is actually not as much cultural reproduction as what happens everywhere outside the, you know, in the institutional matrix. For my small world as a teacher, the best thing with the dynamic of unionization is that students are now beginning to confront the view that the culture of hierarchy is not the only culture sanctified on a college campus. So when you are fighting to build egalitarian institutions on a college campus, just the fact of that fighting is a cultural assault on the dominant cultural framework on a campus. Just the fact that you may create egalitarian spaces challenges the broad culture of hierarchy, where the janitor is somebody down there and, you know, the college president and the students are up here. And personally, it's taken me a very long time to understand this. And this is my last story for you. I have an office which is near the toilet in the hall of my campus, in my building. And, you know, when I got there to the college many years ago, 13 years ago, you know, I used to dress like this and go there and sit in my desk and I'd feel, you know, the campus lefty. I didn't have to wear a tie or a bow tie. George Will is one of our grads, and so is Tucker Carlson, and they both wear bow ties. So I used to say, you know, this will be the inverse of the. I sit down in my office, desk facing the door. Students would, every day or twice a day sometimes, a student would just walk in, no knock, where's the toilet? And I'd be like, what the hell, you know, I mean, there's a white guy next door. Do you ever go into his office and say, where's the toilet? I mean, why do you come to my office? And it took me many years to recognize that my reaction was horrible. Because my reaction was the classical culture of hierarchy, multiculturalist reaction to these students. Because what I was really saying to the students in my interior dialogue with them was that, why am I the janitor? You know, because the janitor is somebody else. You know, I'm a professor. I'm not the janitor. When actually my response should be, well, why do we have the concept janitor? You know, why should I feel outraged that you think I'm the janitor? That's the culture of hierarchy. That, you know, all these upwardly mobile ideologies promote the view that we should be outraged if we're mistaken for another human being. That's how pernicious the culture of hierarchy is. So I'm very happy to come to, you know, any institutional gathering of unionists who are trying to make any kind of egalitarian culture on campuses. So everything you do makes my world better, and it certainly makes me recognize how much that culture of hierarchy has permeated all of us. Thanks a lot. Yes, please.
Just a little bit of personal background so you understand where the question's coming from. I was a graduate employee, sort of activist as a volunteer for a number of years at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where we had this ridiculously long recognition battle, et cetera. And part of the culture there was to talk about a lot of the kinds of things you're saying about it's cultural issues, and the preferred rubric was corporatization, but financialization, right? You know, you could... And that was sort of a lot of the dialogue around it. And when I and then I left there, and now I'm an organizing staff at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's their grad union there, the Teaching Assistants Association. And one of the things that struck me about, and I should say, when I left Illinois, it was just the year after we finally got recognition. So I went from, and the Teaching Assistants Association is the oldest grad employee union in the country. So I went from the most newly minted, so I went from the most newly minted local to the most oldest minted local, and it was, so I had a little bit of whiplash about it. And one of the things I noticed was was that actually so much of my life sort of became about collective bargaining. And collective bargaining alone, and I love me some collective bargaining. This is not a statement against collective bargaining, but I did notice this sort of loss, right? This loss of a wider consciousness about things that So I guess what I'm saying is I've noticed a lot of times grad unions have a hard time dealing with sort of the broader cultural issues. We get caught up in collective bargaining for good reasons, but sometimes the larger issues can get lost in it. And sort of we don't wind up, we get stuck in, to coin a phrase, trade union consciousness, right? And so I'm curious if you have any thoughts about what unions can do to sort of address those. How do we don't get caught up in just collective bargaining?
Well, you know, you use the phrase trade union consciousness. You know, this is not just grad unions. This is the oldest problem within unionism, oldest debate. In 1902, Lenin wrote a piece where he used the phrase economism, the word economism. So, and trade union in that essay of 1902. I mean, this is an old debate. So, yes, of course. But what can union? I mean, it's not a question of what can unions do. It's a question of how can unions do those things. I mean, we all know what unions can do. In other words, you know, be at the front lines of some of these cultural fights. But the question is, how can unions do that? In a way, it's also true that, we get the limitations that we deserve. In other words, the history of each institution is different and how it gets institutionalized. In some places, age produces safety and you get habits accruing. And people may be surprised to see, my feeling is that every institution provides the openings. Not a year goes by on any college campus where there's no problem of, say, blackface. Not a year goes by when on any college campus there's no epidemic of sexual violence. These things are routine. They are, if I may be so crude, these are opportunities. And all it takes is it takes you to take your local and to hold it by the throat. There was the old Alinsky idea that you only go where your members want you to go. And you know the result from that, which was the back of the yards fiasco, where the members said, we want to organize against integration. And the Alinskyite model is trapped by that. You know, if your members say we want to be barbaric, you have to follow them. So it's your job there to be that forceful hand. I mean, I know those debates about the role of staff versus the role of members, you know, ideology. Is it to be, you know, are we gateways of our membership or are we to shape the membership? some of those debates are parochial. I mean, our current times don't allow us to get stuck by those habits. You know, there's some brutal stuff happening on college campuses, brutal cultural things that are happening. And if unions, which are the heart of egalitarian culture, are not going to intervene, then it's not going to see growth. And I mean cultural growth. I don't mean just numbers. People will join because collective bargaining can bring some benefits. But you need to have cultural leadership, not just leadership for your sectoral, you know, understanding. And that's what I would like to see promoted, is the idea that the union is a cultural visionary. That we have, that the institution produces the culture of hierarchy, and we produce the culture of democracy. We produce the culture of egalitarianism. We are the counterpoint to institutional fascism. Because for every sexual violence that's silenced, or for every attack on somebody because of their ethnicity, is every time anything is silenced, you know, it's that institutional thing that needs to be raised. You know, I mean, I'll give you an example that a survey, when this is going back a while, when I was a student, we did a survey of violence on our campus. And it was interesting because it became clear that whereas the college said that violence comes from outside, that most violence occurred intra-campus and was silenced, so that the campus would routinely send bulletins explaining where people were held up, but they never said where people were raped. So the geography of danger was always about darkness, the other side of the walls. So we produced a counter-geography. You know, that's the kind of thing that unions should be doing, is producing counter-geographies, producing a counter-bulletin, saying, here, you want danger? Here's danger. The president's office. That's danger. Because he's cutting next year so much money from your this, that, you know. You produce a different, you know, do things like that. Aggressive things. Let them shut you down. There's always other jobs to have.
I should say for the record that I actually have found the TA to be very good about these things.
But that's what I would say, you know, that it really there's, it's not what to do, it's how to do it. Because the what we all know, the how is up to each institution. And that's, you know, that's the bad habits we all inherit. Yes, please.
I'm just going to add that I think also bargaining, if you don't let it become just about numbers, is a place where people can really start to understand that they can change their own institution, because a lot of people don't do anything because they think they have no means of action, even when they're members of a union. But if you involve everyone in the bargaining process and help them see that if they take a stand, they can, they, that's a time when they're face-to-face with the highest levels of management, and they can refuse to back down on issues that are important to them, and they can make the institution change because they refuse to back down. It's a really great rallying.
Easy. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
This is Active Ingredients, online at activeingredients.org. You have been listening to Vijay Prashad at Food for Thought Books in Amherst.